Okay, we're going to continue with our final lecture entitled The Scientific Fact Equal Biblical Truth, DNA and Torah Law. Just even recently here at the show, some people had questions about how DNA can affect status. If you're a Kohen, if you're a Jew, if you're this, if you're that, does DNA matter when it comes to issues of halacha? And so without further ado, we'll give the podium back over to Rabbi Gurkov. I should mention, if in case you don't know, there are books for sale. You know, if you'd like, after the talk, you're welcome to purchase them on Chabad, and we can work out the payment if you don't have checks with you now.
I just need to know up front, how long do we have till 4?
So 2 minutes to 4, so I can wrap it up.
Okay, 2 minutes to 4.
2 minutes.
Right, I heard that once Isaac Batsheva Singer got up to give a commencement speech in front of the university. And when the audience sits down, he gets up to the podium and he says, "Mr. President, about what should I speak?" And a gasp goes up through the audience, and the president gets up and says, "Mr. Singer, about 20 minutes." So, the rabbi just mentioned the Kohen gene. And we almost probably all know about this gene. And then it has recently been discovered, and it's fascinating. The fact that so many Kohanim across the world were tested and found to have a common gene, which attests to the fact that our tradition that claimed that the people today that are known to be Kohanim are in fact all descendants from the very small unit of Aharon and his two sons and his grandson Pinchas, that seems to prove it as far as we're concerned. So the question then becomes, do we believe they're Kohanim today because their parents told them so, or do we believe they're Kohanim today because we have a far superior method of determining that or of ascertaining that because we found their DNA gene? And where it really hits home, if someone is told by his father, "You're not a Kohen," and then he turns out to have that gene, do we allow that person the status of Kehuna, of priesthood? So, in reality, we would still, and halakhically, we would still follow the tradition we always followed until now, where if you are a Kohen, your father would tell you so. And if your father didn't tell you so, then we don't think you are a Kohen. When news of this gene came out, as far as Jewish believers were concerned, this wasn't a corroboration of something we weren't sure of, but this was a corroboration of something we had always taken to be true anyway. I'll give you an example. I heard that one time the Rebbe of Ger, the Gerer Rebbe, Ger is a Hasidic group, and the Rebbe of Ger was in Israel in 1948, and an envoy from the British Mandate came to visit the Rebbe of Ger and said to the Rebbe that, "I have great news to share with you. The British government is going to respond to the UN instruction to return Israel to the Jewish people." And the Rebbe's response was a very Hungarian, "Michitaisa." And Michitaisa essentially means, okay, big deal. And the interpreter didn't know what to make of that. So the interpreter said, "The Rebbe's very happy to hear this wonderful news." And then after the envoy left, the interpreter asked the Rebbe, "What do you mean, Michitaisa? This is big news. We're getting the country back." He says, "Look, God promised the country to Abraham Avinu. God promised the country to Yitzhak Avinu. God promised the country to Yaakov Avinu. Now the British government wants to promise it to us too. Mechitaisa. Let them promise it too." In other words, from his standpoint, Israel is ours and that is a fact because we believe it is so. Now, the world has caught up with our truth. That was his approach. And that was the approach that we took when we discovered this Kohen gene. The Jewish people took the approach. We've always known these people are Kohen. And now science has caught up with the truth we've always held to be true. But we didn't then say we know it to be true now because science tells us so. We know it to be true because we have implicit faith in the vibrancy of our tradition. It works. If we didn't believe that parents will transmit the tradition in purity to the next generation, then we wouldn't have a Jewish tradition today. We wouldn't have the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral tradition. We wouldn't have had a Talmud. The only reason we have it is because we loyally transmit our tradition from generation to generation. If that's true of Torah, It's also true within the family unit that a father takes his responsibility seriously to tell his son, you are a Kohen. And if the father didn't tell him so, he's likely not a Kohen. Do you remember, you probably all know the story of the fellow who came to the rabbi and said, I need to be a Kohen and it doesn't matter what it costs? Everybody know that story? Anyone doesn't? I'll tell it for those who don't. So he said, I'm willing to pay $100,000 if you'd make me a Kohen. And the rabbi said, this is something you're born with. You can't be converted into kahuna. And he said, I'll pay you $1,000,000. And the rabbi thinks, no, how bad could it be if I tell him he's a Kohen and he's not? $1,000,000? I can do a lot of good with $1,000,000. Well, finally, the rabbi concocts a ceremony, sprinkles some water on the man's head, and he says, you're a Kohen, you're a Kohen, you're a Kohen. Takes $1,000,000 and says to him, so tell me, why did you want it so badly? He says, of course I wanted it. My father is a Kohen. His father before him was a Kohen. And the father before him was a Kohen. So I want to be a Kohen. Why are you laughing? Because it's inevitable that if his father and grandfather and great-father were a Kohen, he should know he's a Kohen too. What type of fool can make $1,000,000 and part with $1,000,000 and not know that his father is a Kohen? Because it doesn't work that way for us. From the standpoint, let's talk a little bit about DNA. How do we regard new scientific methodology that arises over time? And DNA is not the first one. Blood testing, for example, was also a methodology that arose to determine identity. It wasn't as accurate as DNA, but it was something that rabbis had to deal with and confronted in the early part of the 20th century. So let me tell you a fascinating story that goes back to Rav Sadia Gaon. I couldn't pinpoint it for you, but I'm going to take a guess that it's the 7th century or the 8th century. Rav Sadia Gaon, there's a story that's told in a book called Sefer Chasidim, that a wealthy man left the city with his slave, and he came back. No, sorry, he died abroad. The slave returned, and it was many years later, and the slave claimed to be the son of the man who had departed. And he came back with all of the man's wealth and laid claim to it. A little while later, another man appeared and claimed to be the man's actual son and said, I know this other fellow, he's my father's slave. So Rav Sadia Gaon devised a test that no one had ever heard of since, and he did the following. He exhumed the body and excised the bone from the body. And then he drew blood from the son and from the slave. And then he dipped the bone into the two pools of blood. And the bone absorbed the blood from one and not from the other. And Rav Sadia then awarded the estate to the one whose blood was absorbed in the deceased man's bone. Now, no one knows the science of this particular test. It's a legend that has been passed down. We can't derive halacha from legends. But it does tell us that our rabbis were willing to experiment with methodologies that aren't exclusively halachic. In the Talmud, we also have a story about a sage by the name of Rabbi Bana'a. Rabbi Bana'a once dealt with the question of a man who died. He had 10 children. And he got up and he said, of all my 10 children, only one of them is really mine. And then he died. We don't know if his wife was still alive or not, but hopefully she wasn't. That would be quite, rather embarrassing for her. Rabbi Bana then had all 10 children assemble at the father's grave, and he gave them each a stick. And he instructed them each to strike their father's grave. And 9 out of the 10 struck the grave, and the 10th said, I can't. And he awarded the entire estate to the one. So again, a methodology that tells us something, even if it isn't halachic. That's just a story I want to share to start the discussion. It doesn't tell us anything about DNA, but it does open the discussion for us. So let us then begin. What is the problem with accepting DNA evidence from a halakhic standpoint? There are a number of problems. The first problem is one that the recently deceased Rabbi Avadia Yosef brought up as an objection to use of DNA. He says, there is no mention of DNA at all in the Talmud. If you don't have Talmudic precedent for it, then how do you know that in fact it could be considered halakhically? There's a rabbi in Milwaukee who's very, very involved in this kind of area of halakha. His name is Rav Mendel Senderovich. And Rav Mendel Senderovich says, but the Talmud also doesn't specifically say that you can't use DNA. And he offers an example. The example is related to the laws of the Etrog, the citron that we use on Purim, on Sukkot. And he says with respect to the Etrog, there's always a question whether the Etrog is from a pure Etrog tree or if it's a lemon hybrid. And there are a number of signs, telltale signs, that are visible on the lemon hybrid. One of them is a particular kind of ridge. And there are two very well accepted halakhic authorities in the previous century, the Mishnah Brura and the Chatam Sofer, and both of them said that those particular signs can't be used because they are not brought in the Talmud. So can we then take a precedent from this, that anything that doesn't appear in the Talmud is out of bounds for us? Says Rav Senderovich, no, it doesn't work really. Because that is a unique case. The Talmud offers many signs that tell us what is a kosher etrog. And if it didn't offer this particular sign, then you see reason to exclude it. The Talmud chose to exclude it. And then he raises the possibility that there might not have been lemon hybrids in Talmudic times, but that's an aside. You can't really derive from the etrog phenomenon that what's not in the Talmud is not to be used, because there's no discussion of DNA in the Talmud, neither positive nor negative. With respect to the etrog, there are many signs that are brought in the Talmud, so the fact that one is omitted should speak to us. So there is a vibrant discussion about DNA among leading halakhic decisors in our generation, and many of them that have recently passed on as well. We've lost a number of very prominent halakhic decisors in our time. Rabbi Avadia Yosef just passed away. May he be of great may his memory be blessed. We've also recently lost Rabbi El Yashiv. May his memory be blessed. Rabbi Shmuel Vosner is still with us. May he live many long years. And so...
He's not.
Have we lost them too?
As of like a month ago.
A month ago?
Yeah.
Baruch Dayan Emes. Right, no, I remember now.
102 years old, just passed away.
And these Rabbanim, and also Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who has dealt with this particular question, and he's passed on a little while ago. So these issues have been dealt with in the last 20, 30 years. So let's talk about what kind of proof we need to determine a halakhic truth. It really depends on the subject. There are certain subjects that require a very high standard of halakhic proof. I saw earlier today when I was here and you were presenting, we were talking about one who violates the laws of Shabbos, and that the punishment for that is a capital punishment. One is put to death. But to know for certain that one has violated the law, the Torah requires two witnesses. And the witnesses must be male, and they must be Jewish, and they must not be related to each other, nor must they be related, nor can they be related to a sinner, to the sinner himself. And so there are many criteria that must be met before we can accept the testimony of these witnesses. And minus testimony from two kosher witnesses, we do not, in fact, administer punishment for any sin. So, for example, take the sin of murder. The punishment for murder is execution. But before a Bet Din, the Jewish body of law, can execute a murderer, there would have to be a standard of proof that rises to the level of two kosher witnesses who testify that they saw the murderer commit the act of murder. But they have to have both seen him at the same time. So, for example, if they were looking through a keyhole and one looked, and then the other looked, they didn't see him at the same time, they can't be considered a unit. As a matter of fact, if they had seen the act of murder from two separate vantage points, and they couldn't see each other from those two vantage points, then their testimony cannot be considered halakhically. Circumstantial evidence is not accepted. If we walk into a room and see a man sitting on the couch, we walk out, we know no one is in that room but that man, we see another man walk into the room with a knife, and then we see him walking out with a bloody knife. And then we walk in and see that the man that was on the couch is dead from a wound to the heart, a stab to the heart. That's considered circumstantial, and a beddin cannot execute the murderer on that evidence. Now, let it be known that there are other methods they can employ. They can imprison for life, they can administer all kinds of, not biblical lashes, but they can administer lashes of some sort. But the level of halachic truth that must be met in order to administer the punishment of execution is two kosher witnesses, none related to each other or the sinner, who see the murder, act of murder at the same time from a common vantage point. And as you mentioned earlier, Rabbi Amram, they had to also have warned him within moments of the act, and he had to have acknowledged sanely, they had to be able to say that he was sane at the time, acknowledge the murder, acknowledge that the act is sinful, that there is a punishment, he understands it and is doing it anyway. So we see from this that there are two completely separate tracks. One is the question of what happened, and the other is the question of whether enough information has come to us that would create the requirement to punish. We might know without a doubt that this particular person committed an act of murder, but that doesn't mean that we are now required to administer punishment. It's a fascinating thought. We can use DNA to determine that this fellow committed the act of murder. But on the basis of that information, we cannot yet administer the punishment, the capital punishment. Now, why is that? I'd like to take a few moments to offer my own theory as to why that is. It's based on the concept that in Jewish law, punishment is not punitive, but it is an atonement. If we are punished for our sins in this world, our soul transitions into the afterlife without the baggage of sin. So when a Bet Din executes a murderer, it's not just punitive, and it's not just a deterrent for other murderers, it's actually an atonement for the soul of the murderer. The question is this Bet Din empowered to offer, to administer atonement for this murderer or not? It's not just a question of whether they know that this man is a murderer, but are they spiritually empowered to atone for this act of murder? And the Torah tells us that the only way a body of law, a Bet Din, can be empowered to act as a vehicle for atonement is when all these criteria are met. So you might know a fact of truth, but you're not empowered to administer atonement to the sinner, which is a very different phenomenon. So you see how we're splitting hairs? I'm pulling a Clinton-esque. I'm saying, yes, we might know for a fact that DNA evidence is acceptable and this tells us the truth, but that doesn't empower us to punish, because punishment in Jewish law is a form of atonement. Now, maybe afterwards, if you want to stay on, I can elaborate on that a little bit more, because I have a theory on why a Bet Din is not empowered to atone unless two witnesses could see from a common vantage point. But I don't want to take up the time now. Let's move on. When we talk about a requirement to rise to that level of knowledge, two witnesses who testify, having seen from a common vantage point, who are both kosher male Jews, and who are not related to each other or to the sinner, that is with respect to any criminal act. But there are other instances in Jewish law that we might be able to use DNA evidence. For example, after 9/11, the Rabbinical Council of America, the RCA, convened a commission to determine, to identify the remains of the Jewish victims. And their purpose was manifold. First, they wanted to be able to collect the remains to bury as much of the body parts that they could. And they wanted to ascertain that they're burying the same body parts in the particular grave. But the more important element here was permitting the widow to remarry. So you have to now find evidence of death in order to permit the widow to remarry. This is called in halacha the laws of an aguna. Someone who is agun means they're tied down. They're tied down to the husband that they don't know for certain is deceased, and therefore cannot remarry, and is a tragic phenomenon. So after 9/11, the RCA was looking for ways to corroborate the death of the men so that the women, the widows, would have at least the option of remarriage. So they turned to the Rabbanut in Israel, and they asked for an opinion on whether DNA evidence can be used under these conditions. And it's fascinating. Rabbi Avad Yosef did not agree for the reasons I shared earlier. It's not in the Talmud, but he found alternate methods that he did permit halachically for identification purposes. And there were others, like Rabbi Nechemya Goldberg, who was adamantly in support of using DNA evidence. And he wasn't alone. There were a whole list. Rabbi Waldenberg supported the use of DNA evidence, not after 9/11, he had already passed on before that, but Rabbi Auerbach permitted the use of DNA evidence, and so did Rabbi Eliashib, and to a certain degree also Rabbi Wasner. Many, many great leading rabbis of the generation permitted the use of DNA evidence for the purposes of permitting a widow to remarry. But this is a unique form of halacha, because the rabbis were famously lenient with respect to this area of halacha. And by that I mean, the rabbis were willing to accept evidence from a non-Jew, although usually a Jewish witness is required in order to give testimony in a Jewish court. In fact, the rabbis were willing to permit evidence of hearsay. And Rambam, Maimonides, explains why. He says, no one would really be willing to give testimony for a fact that they might very well be discovered to be lying about. So no one would say, I know so-and-so has died if so-and-so can show up tomorrow. So the rabbis were more lenient with respect to this question. Of course, if so-and-so showed up tomorrow and the widow had already remarried, that creates a new tragedy. She would have to then be divorced from her second husband. But that's a separate issue. The rabbis were famously lenient, not requiring the level of testimony that is required for a criminal case in order to allow remarriage for an aguna. As a matter of fact, the rabbis were willing to permit what's called a siman, a sign, an indicator that this person is deceased. And they actually codify three different levels of indicator. Weak indicators, intermediate indicators, and strong indicators. A weak indicator would be, I recognize that it was Mr. Sender because I saw a tall man lying dead. A short man lying dead. A pale-toned skinned man lying dead. A dark-toned skinned man lying dead. That's a weak indicator. There are too many tall, short, pale, dark men. What's a strong indicator? I saw somebody lying dead with, let's say, a extremely deformed arm. That's a strong indicator. That's a unique form of it's a unique deformity that is true of very few people. And I know that your husband had that unique deformity, therefore I know that it's him. Interestingly enough, 100 years ago, they didn't consider a hole in the tooth a unique deformity because dentistry wasn't as common as it is today. So therefore, many people had rotten teeth. Today, dental work is accepted as not just an indicator, but a strong indicator. Not only because dental hygiene is a lot better now than it ever was, but also because dental records are much more meticulous than just the question of whether there's a hole in the teeth. So dental records are commonly used to identify the remains of the deceased in order to allow the widow to remarry. An intermediate indicator would be when you say that someone has a long neck, for example, an elongated neck. It's unique, but it's not so unique. As a general rule in halacha, two intermediate indicators can combine to make a strong indicator. So two somewhat unique features about a person could be considered a strong indication. Many common indicators could combine to become an intermediate indicator. And an intermediate indicator in and of itself is not enough of a proof. It needs some kind of corroborating evidence along with it, then we'll consider the intermediate indicator. Now, the commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, the Beit Shmuel, actually quantified a strong indicator, and he said, if it's something that is not likely to be seen in more than one man in 1,000, Gesundheit, then indeed it's a strong indicator. Although there might be 2 men out of 2,000, and you saw the wrong one, the likelihood of that is very low. If 1 in 1,000 has that deformity, it's more than likely a unique and strong indication that you saw that man. Well, DNA has an accuracy of 1 in 10 billion, and some say 1 in quintillion. DNA's accuracy is far greater than any of the indicators our rabbis were willing to consider. So on this basis, most of the rabbis were willing to allow DNA evidence to permit the widow to remarry. The only holdout was Rabbi Avad Yosef of blessed memory, simply because, on principle, you don't see that information in the Talmud. Otherwise, there aren't any other rabbis that I saw of note that objected to the use of DNA for the purpose of allowing the widow to remarry. Rav Shmuel Vosner, however, had a very interesting criteria. He allowed DNA evidence, but he only allowed it as an intermediate indicator. And it's odd, because if a strong indicator is 1 in 1,000, why should DNA evidence be any less than that? But when we consider his next criteria, it'll start making sense. His second criteria was, it's only an intermediate indicator if you've got a sample from one of his children. Right? Because DNA evidence can be compared to the child. The same DNA streams will be found in the children as in the father. But if you find a sample of the husband himself, like if you find a hair follicle on his pillow and you can take some samples from his remains, then it's a strong indicator. Why would he have instituted this particular requirement? There's a rabbi by the name of Chaim Jablon. He wrote a series of books called Gray Matter. He's also online at a website called Kol Torah with a K, KOLTORAH.org. And he has fascinating articles about these things. And he speculated about this particular requirement of Rav Vosner, that unless the information is collected directly from the deceased's own hair or own body, the DNA evidence can only be seen as intermediate and not as strong indicator. And to explain that, I need to move away from the question of allowing the widow to remarry, the Aguna question, to a much more impactful question of mamzer, of bastardhood. Suppose you administer the DNA test to find out if the husband has deceased. And in the course of that test, you discover that the father, the deceased father, is not the father of the son. This is information that came to you inadvertently, indirectly. You weren't looking for it. Kind of like the Eino Michaven. It wasn't your intention. But the information came your way. Now the question is, do we have to declare the son a mamzer, a bastard, because his married mother conceived him with a man that was not her husband? We weren't looking for that information, but it's come to us now. Right? What happens then? Is it sort of an everything or nothing proposition? Do we have to have integrity and say, if we accept this DNA evidence to allow the widow to remarry, we also need to accept it and declare the son a mamzer? What is the ramification of being a mamzer? It's terrible. You can't marry a non-Jew because you're Jewish. You can't marry a Jew because you're a mamzer. You can only marry a fellow mamzer. A girl who is a mamzer can marry a boy who is a mamzer, and vice versa. And their children will remain mamzerim as well. It's a terrible decree. Are we duty-bound to declare the son a mamzer? And this is where we have serious reservations. Because we're not anxious to run around declaring children mamzer. But what do you do? Sometimes you discover that in fact there has been a marital indiscretion. No one knew, and the information came to your hands. Well, you know, in Talmudic logic there is always a loophole. You can always look at it kind of this way. And you can say this: what do we really know? We know that the father is not the father of the son. But do we know who the father really is? Maybe the father wasn't Jewish. And the halacha is that if a Jewish married woman has relations with a non-Jew, the child is not a mamzer. The child is only a mamzer if the child was fathered by a Jewish man with a woman who was married to another Jewish man. Since we haven't really interrogated the mom, and we haven't asked her whether she had an affair with a Jew or a non-Jew, Could we simply sit back and say, we don't have enough information to declare the child a mamzer, we're going to go out of our way not to ask the information, don't tell, don't know, right? Tell no, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. And we don't have enough information to declare the son a mamzer. Can we do that? Some rabbis say, yes, we could do that. Others say we can only do that if the mother corroborates and says it was a non-Jewish father. Others say as long as she didn't say it wasn't a non-Jewish a Jewish father, we can assume it was a non-Jewish father, etc. And then, Rabbi Willig, who is the Rosh Yeshiva of the Rabbi Isaac Ohanan Theological Seminary, and he is also very active in the OU, he was part of the RCA commission after 9/11, he made the argument that it is quite possible that the child has another father, but that the mom was artificially inseminated. Which raises a whole other question for another Yom Limud. What is the definition of, what is the status of a child who is the product of a married woman from another man's sperm, but it was artificially inseminated? And just briefly, most of the rabbis would agree that the child is not rendered a mamzer. So we have all kinds of sort of loopholes to avoid needing to declare the son a mamzer. Why are we so anxious to do that? Rabbi Jablon testifies that Reb Moshe Feinstein, and I'm sure many of you have heard of Reb Moshe Feinstein, he passed on in 1985, back in Europe, he advised Rabbi Jablon's father on an evening in which he knew a mamzer to be married. He said, better just leave town that night, but don't out the mamzer. In other words, this was a person that the Rav in the community knew he was a mamzer. But no one else remembered, sort of the facts had been lost over time. And now this fellow was getting married to a proper Jewish woman. And the rabbi knew. Comes the question, is the rabbi required to inform the community, this man's a mamzer and this is a forbidden wedding? Well, he wouldn't go so far as to actually officiate at the wedding, knowing that the groom is a mamzer or the bride is a mamzeress. But to make yourself absent on that night, to make yourself scarce, so that you wouldn't be in a position that you have to object, is something the rabbis would do, because we go out of our way to avoid outing a mamzer that has assimilated somehow into the community. It's based on the Talmud and the end of the tractate of Kiddushin. The Talmud says, Kivan shenitma, with an ayin at the end, it doesn't mean became impure. It means once they have assimilated within the community, nitma, they're assimilated. They lose the status of mamzer, and there's no need to out them. Furthermore, the Talmud goes on to say that when Mashiach comes, he will announce the lineage of every Jewish person. So we'll actually know who our great-grandparents are. And this way we'll know who's really a Kohen, with the gene or without the gene, who's really a Levi, who's really a Yisrael. But one thing he will not do, he will not out those who have become assimilated, whether they're non-Jews who over time, they've somehow their lineage has become involved in the Jewish community and they've been accepted as Jews, Mashiach will not out them. Or if they're a mamzer that over time their status has been forgotten and over the generations the children have been accepted into the community, Mashiach will not out them. And the reverse is also true. If Mashiach knows of a Jew that has assimilated to the point that they're no longer part of the Jewish community, Mashiach will not out them either and declare them to be Jewish and bring them back in. So it's not to bring close those who are far, nor is it to push away those who are close. It's just to ascertain the lineage of those who are in the community. On this basis, we go off and say that there's no requirement to out a mamzer once they have been assimilated into the community. Therefore, if a mamzer known to the Rav is getting married and the community doesn't know that he or she is a mamzer, the Rav should make himself scarce on that night. Let another Rav who doesn't know the status officiate at the wedding. In fact, one of the commentators to that particular passage in the Talmud, Rabbi Nissim, the Ran, he goes off and he says, Mashiach will in fact at that point even embrace the known mamzer. According to the Ran, it goes so far that the known mamzer will be embraced in the community. So we can appreciate now why rabbis are so hesitant to declare a mamzer. As a matter of fact, Rabbi Yoshev was once asked when a woman who was pregnant declared that her husband is not the father, and after the birth, the father said to Rabbi Yoshev, am I required to take a DNA test to ensure that my son is really my son or not? And Rabbi Yoshev said, don't do that. because we have no obligation to out a potential or possible mamzer. That tells us two things. It tells us, number one, that DNA evidence is strong enough to declare the child a mamzer. And number two, it tells us that we go out of our way to avoid using it for that purpose. Now we go back to, remember I told you Rav Vosner said that for purposes of allowing the widow to remarry, he only would permit it if the information was collected directly from remains of the deceased. But if it was taken from the son, then it would only be considered an intermediate indicator and not a strong indicator. So Rabbi Jablon speculates perhaps Rav Vosner's purpose here was a brilliant solution to avoid encouraging collecting DNA evidence from the son in case we inadvertently discover a problem we'd rather not know, open up Pandora's box we'd rather not open. Now we don't have that information directly from Rav Vosner, and as Rabbi Brook just told us, unfortunately we can't ask him anymore until Mashiach comes. But Rabbi Willig, who I mentioned earlier, was part of the RCA group. He was very adamant that we should not avoid any method available to us to allow the widow to remarry on the concern that we might discover the son is a mamzer. And he activated here the principle in halacha, ein dochi nefesh mipnei nefesh, we never reject one soul for another. So for example, if a woman is giving birth and the child has already emerged, the head has already emerged from the opening, and at that point there is a danger, and it's either the child's life or the mother's life. Once the child's head has emerged, the child is considered an independent person, and we can't kill the child to save the mother, nor the mother to save the child. Ein dochi nefesh mipnei nefesh. If a bandit comes to the shul, God forbid, and says, send us out one woman so we could rape her, or we're going to come into the shul and rape all the women, we don't volunteer any one woman to save other women. Ein dochi nefesh mipnei nefesh. We wouldn't castigate the widow to a life of isolation just because we don't want to know whether her son is a mamzer. Therefore, Rabbi Willig says, there's no need to worry about it. We can always just conclude that the mother was artificially inseminated. That was Rabbi Willig who said that. So what we've done is we've already declared that in criminal cases, DNA evidence might tell us what happened, but it doesn't rise to the level that would allow us to administer punishment. For that, we'd need two kosher witnesses, etc. We've already determined that DNA evidence is allowed to be used and can be used and is used to allow widows to remarry. We have also determined that DNA evidence is strong enough to out a son if we discover he's a mamzer, but we do whatever we can to avoid making that declaration, to sort of turn our back on that information. To support this, we also have an interesting halachic, Talmudic passage. We know that our sages were famously lenient with allowing the widow to be remarried. So DNA evidence can be employed to allow the widow to be remarried. But in the Talmud we find a fascinating halacha. If a husband leaves and he's away for 12 months, and 12 months later his wife gives birth, we don't declare the son a mamzer, because the rabbis are willing to consider the remote, freakish possibility that the woman went through a 12-month gestation. Now, I don't know where these numbers come from, but I did a little bit of digging on the internet, and somebody wrote that 1 in 2 million pregnancies can last for 11 months. They don't anymore because doctors won't let it go that long. They induce, but naturally speaking, they can go as far as 11 months with the baby still being born.
Still missing a month.
Yes, still missing a month. So the rabbis were prepared to consider outlandish, freakish possibilities to avoid declaring the son a mamzer. Therefore, says Rabbi Willig, we are on solid ground when we refuse to use DNA evidence to declare the son a mamzer. What about determining parental rights and parental obligations? If it turns out that I deny this is my son, but DNA evidence actually shows that it is my son, Can a Jewish court enforce child payments? Right? Now, when it came to blood testing, rabbis were very reluctant to do that on the basis of information of evidence that is collected from blood tests. And they made the following argument. There's a concept in halacha called a chazaka, a presumption. We presume that a married woman sleeps primarily, if not exclusively, with her husband. So she has a child, the assumption is that it's her husband's child. We have another presumption that a very high degree, a very high percentage of test results, of blood test results, are accurate. And so if in fact these test results show that someone else is the father, then there is presumptive evidence to show that someone else is the father. We can require people to make payments on a chazaka, on a presumption. But when we have two conflicting presumptions, then we don't have enough evidence to require someone to make a payment. So they therefore argue that the presumption of most children are the sons of their mother's husband, versus the presumption that most blood tests have accurate results, they said that's not enough information to require the stranger, who by blood test is identified as the father, to make child payments. When it comes to DNA evidence, however, rabbis are more than willing, almost all rabbis, very few are resistant to the idea, more than willing to allow DNA evidence to require the father to make payments. So one of the reasons is the high degree of accuracy. Rabbi Auerbach, who was very resistant, who was the one who actually formulated the argument that I just shared with you about blood tests, he said at first that for DNA evidence he'd be willing to consider it as long as it had some corroborating evidence as well. And finally concluded when the science became so fine-tuned to the point that it is today, where the accuracy rate is 1 in 10 billion or 1 in quintillion, that it can stand on its own as a piece of evidence that can require the father to make parental payments for the child. So indeed, if God forbid, it is discovered that the child you thought was yours actually belongs to your neighbor down the road, then halacha would, on the basis of DNA evidence, require the neighbor to make child payments. There's another area of halacha that we would need to ask, and that is with respect to one of the concerns that the RCA Bet Din had about burying the remains of a fellow in one grave. Can you use DNA evidence to ascertain that this arm belongs with this leg and this torso with this head? And there, even the most hesitant rabbis were prepared to allow DNA evidence, and they actually used it on many occasions in the post-9/11 RCA commission. Since we're talking about that, it's fascinating to bring up another element of that particular commission. Number one, the rabbis determined that they would have to observe personally the laboratory that did the testing. Because when you're going to make a statement that DNA evidence actually shows the following results, it's not sufficient to have that statement made by someone who doesn't have a great deal of reverence and regard for Jewish law. Now, with respect to the reporting, that issue has been raised as well in halacha. Can we rely on the reports of a non-Jewish professional? On the one hand, he has his own integrity to be concerned with. And if it comes out that he lied deliberately or even inadvertently, then he can lose his license. In and of itself, that should be sufficient reason to rely on that testing and on those results. But I will tell you that I was once at a workshop where a fellow who owns a lab for artificial insemination, so he holds a sperm library in his lab in Chicago. He actually told us that on one occasion they opened a sperm that was supposedly, it was labeled as a human sperm and an individual human sperm, and it turned out to be animal sperm. So human error is a real reality. But do we have to be concerned for that, or should we just simply rely on the integrity of the technician in the lab? Well, there is a robust debate that goes on about whether we can rely on the reporting or not, but the RCA Commission wasn't willing to rely on it, and they actually applied for permission and were granted permission to actually access the library, the laboratory of the New York... what is it called again? The office, the coroner, medical examiner. And they watched the testing take place. And Rabbi Yonah Ries from the RCA office, he testified that he saw them repeat the test 5 times before they were prepared to announce the results.
This is what most hospitals in New York, Los Angeles, and the bigger in Israel do with in vitro fertilization. There's a mashgiach, there's a full-time rabbi, his name is Rabbi Yakubovich of New York, who's in every room, wherever they're doing, transferring their sperm from room to room. There's constant supervision.
This and he places his hashgacha seal on the vial, and he won't allow it unless the hashgacha is still, if the seal is still locked.
Correct.
When it's opened on the other end. Yep, I remember discussing it in Sydney with Rabbi Yoram Ullman, who was also very involved in this particular area of halacha. So, with that in mind, let's look at another area in the RCA commission. And they found, it's gruesome to discuss, but it is an interesting halachic point, they found a leg that had pants, a pant leg that was dressed on the leg, and there was a wallet with an identifying license on that leg. Halacha tells us that you can't rely on someone's clothing as an indicator that it belongs to that person. Because there is a possibility that somebody else put on my pants that day and went to work. Nevertheless, the contemporary halachasists argue that we live in a society where people don't loan out their pants. We live in a society where people wear pants to measure. They get tailored to measure. You won't wear pants that are too short or too long. Maybe 150 years ago, people weren't so concerned about the size of their clothing. And they frequently walked around with long pants, short pants, gray pants, white pants. But today, people are very particular about their wardrobe, and it's very uncommon for me to let someone else wear my pants to work. On that basis, they actually declared someone dead because they found a leg encased in pants with a wallet that had an identifying mark on it. Well, obviously it was identification in the wallet. But here's an interesting story. I remember reading the story in the media. It came out a couple of years ago. There was a jogger who was murdered on the jogging path. And the police couldn't find any identification because most people who run don't run with their wallet. But they found his key. And the key fob, they went to the closest parking lot, and the key fob opened a car on the lot. And so they examined the ownership of the car, and they informed their family that the fellow passed away. Well, you know key fobs can sometimes open more than one car. Turns out that after the funeral, the man came home. And they, in fact, had buried, quote unquote, the wrong man. They didn't bury the wrong man, but they buried him under the wrong identification. So you see how careful you need to be. You can't just make an assumption. Look, I found this key fob. Belongs to his car. We can sometimes be off. You see how careful we need to be. In that case, after careful consideration, they agreed to allow the widow to remarry, and they buried this man, and the family sat Shiva. By the way, another question. Can you sit Shiva on the basis of identifying the deceased by DNA evidence? Rav Vosner argued that it would depend on whether you have sufficient evidence to allow the widow to remarry. Because if your argument is the widow can't remarry, but you know enough to allow the family to sit Shiva, there is a conflict there and there's a confusion. And the widow will feel, we've sat Shiva for my deceased husband, now I could remarry. So to avoid that confusion, he said the family shouldn't sit Shiva unless we have enough evidence that allows us to be comfortable to allow the widow to remarry. One final point, and that is with respect to identifying a person by having seen his features or her features. So a witness comes and says, I saw your husband, he drowned, I recognized his face. The halacha states that if he saw them within 3 days of passing, then you can identify a person by the feature. By after 3 days, the features are so distorted that you cannot be certain that you saw who you think you saw. Now, it's very interesting that Kabbalah teaches us that the soul departs in stages. And the first stage of departure is actually 30 days before passing. And then the moment of passing. And then the moment of interment. And then 3 days later, after the passing, the soul departs again to a certain degree. And then at the 7 day point, the 30 day point, and the 12 month point. So it's interesting that the halacha allows us to identify features within 3 days. And Kabbalah will tell us that there's going to be a certain separation of soul from body that occurs after 3 days, which physically is the time when the body deteriorates further to the point that the features are so bloated or disfigured that you can't know for certain that you saw the person you think you did. So, In the case of post 9/11, that never came up, because in fact, no one had features enough left to be distinguished, to be identified. But I did want to share a story that I saw in a series of books called Little Miracles. If you have that book, it's a wonderful book. If you don't, I recommend it highly. It's a great series of books with little stories of incredible coincidences or heartwarming stories. Kind of like Chicken Soup for the Soul, but I think done much better. In that one of those books, the story was brought of a family that was told that their grandmother passed away. The nursing home where the grandmother was living called to say the grandma passed on. And so they came by and in fact identified the grandmother. But I don't know if you've ever been present at such an identification. They will uncover the face and you'll take a quick look. You don't stand there and examine and look and check and see. People will say, oh yeah, it's funny. And you look and you turn away. And that's what they did. And they gave her a wonderful burial in the family plot. And then, a little while later, they get a call from their grandmother, why aren't you coming to visit? So they called the nursing home, and they actually identified that there were two women that looked alike. And after passing, it was hard to actually determine from the features. It wasn't 3 days later, but it was after passing. People looked a little bit different. And you know, you're already in a state of shock late at night, and they made a mistake. Here's a fascinating ending to the story. They call the family who's got their grandmother buried in the wrong family plot. And they say, you know, you halakhically are allowed to exhume the body if it's for the purpose of burying them in the family plot. They say, you know, your grandmother is buried in our plot. You probably want her. So you're welcome to come and take her because that's our grandmother's spot. And to their horror, the grandson or the son of that other woman says, she was terrible to us. We have no feelings for her. If you buried her, thank God. Otherwise, we would have just given her some kind of government burial. Wherever she is, we're not wasting another dime on her. It's your problem. You want to exhume her, exhume her. And they were shocked. And they thought about it, and they said, you know, this lady never would have had a funeral. We gave her a funeral with 300 people who were concerned about her. 6 months later, their grandmother passed away, so they put her on a plot a little bit further away, and gave her another funeral with 300 people. And they felt it was all from above. So, to conclude, this is a subject that, for the most part, deals with difficult and terrible ordeals. And we look to DNA to see if we can find resolution through DNA. There are other areas of DNA evidence that we started talking about with respect to Kohen, but most of our discussion was unpleasant circumstances. May soon come a time with the arrival of Mashiach that we will no longer need to deal with the halacha of such gruesome and terrible circumstances. May it usher in an era of peace and happiness, prosperity and holiness speedily in our days. Amen, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Gurka, once again. Thank Amram for four wonderful talks. Both Rabbi Amram and Rabbi Gurka are both going to be here. If the amount of hours we had here wasn't enough, you're welcome to stick around and ask more questions. Again, the books are for sale if you'd like them. And thank you all for coming. I hope this was just a stepping stone for continued learning and continued growth in our Yiddishkeit. Have a wonderful day. Thank you.